It's a great pleasure to welcome back to this forum Chris Rosbach. Chris is managing partner of the London-based family office, J. Stern and Company, established to provide investments for the Stern family. It is devoted to long-term investments for families with a multi-generational approach. J. Stern and Co. builds on the Stern family's 200-year-old banking tradition with a conservative approach and institutional-level analysis and resources. Prior to co-founding the firm, Chris had senior investment roles at Marion Capital, Magnetar, Lansdowne Partners, and Perry Capital. He holds a BA from Yale and an MBA from Harvard. Always a pleasure to have you here, Chris. I believe this is now your fifth time. Last time, I believe you presented SICA, which was a truly excellent presentation, and very much look forward to your idea today. I will be back at the conclusion of your remarks, and for now, I'd like to turn the floor to you. Please go ahead.
Great. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, and I appreciate the forum and the opportunity to talk about investing and stocks and to have the exchange with the conference that you've organized. And it has become a fixture in the value investing calendar. So I'm very pleased to participate again here. I want to start off by just saying, as you said, we're a private investment office. We manage money for the Stern family and for other families, trusts, and charities on a very long-term view. So our investment horizon is really 10 to 25 years. And those are the investments that we're looking for. We have positions that the family has held for 40 years or longer. And so when we look for companies, we're not looking for investments that we think will make short-term returns. We're looking for things that have the potential to generate significant returns over time. The basic approach that we have is to look for quality and value. Quality for us is the gating condition, and we define quality as a strong competitive position in a good and growing market of a company that has a long management track record that's aligned with shareholders and a balance sheet that is solid enough to mean that they can prevail regardless of what the economic environment is like, because we want to be in a position to own companies for the long term and not to be forced to sell. We aren't forced to sell because of the nature of our investors, and we don't want to be forced to sell by virtue of issues in the company, whether that's disruption, which we worry about a lot, or balance sheet issues, which can lead to capital increases, which is a form of being forced to sell and to reinvest in companies. In the value investing theories we have, we are more Philip Fisher type investors than Benjamin Graham. So we're looking for the long-term compounding, and the criteria that I laid out, I think, are very aligned with the ones that Philip Fisher has in his book, Common Stocks and Uncommon Values, which I highly recommend to anybody. But that, I think, sets the stage for the types of investments that we're looking for. We have a global approach, but we invest a lot in Europe. So this is a good forum to talk about stocks. And I just want to touch on some of the things I've mentioned in the past over the last several sessions that I've participated in. We talked about MTU, which is the German-based manufacturer of aircraft parts and of servicing. It had a slow start to its development, so I had to give an update after the first year saying that it had been disappointing. But since then, it's returned over 100% in share prices. The second time around, I talked about Henkel, the German consumer products and industrial adhesive company, which has generated 52% the year before. After that, I talked about Dignity, the UK funeral service provider, which has done 3%, so has not performed very well so far. although it's done all right in dollars, actually. But it has been impacted by the uncertainties that have taken place in this country. We still are very confident about it. And if we have an opportunity to meet again through the this conference, I'm confident that it will have generated the returns that we're looking for. And finally, last year, Sika, which has been a long-term holding for us, the Swiss leader in additives for the construction industry and in waterproof membranes, with a strong OE business, but even stronger product prospects in the refurbishment of buildings, which since just last year is up 59%, and I think has a significant prospect. I talked last year about our involvement in the company because we believe in constructive engagement, not confrontation with management. But in Sika, we're in a situation where we have to stand up for our interests in the face of an attempt by the founding family to sell their shares to Saint-Gobain, the French construction company, but without extending the same offer to other shareholders. We've been working alongside other large shareholders, especially the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation Trust, or Cascade as it's known, to stand up for our interests. And that is something that we do when necessary. And the returns have been so far very much justified what we're doing. The offer came at a share price of around 3,000 Swiss francs. It's now heading towards 8,000. So that's quite a return for what I think is one of the best companies in the world. And I recommend that people go back and look at it if you didn't on the basis of what I said last year. So this year, I want to focus on a different company. It's a global leader in its business. It is in the middle of a merger with another global leader that will create a globally dominant company in its industry. It has had a good share price performance over time, but has recently suffered from near-term issues that may have been caused by some of the dislocation around the merger and by people not focusing on the combined company in the way that markets look for things to complete before they adjust for it. So we have all the things that we're looking for in investing. We have the quality of an outstanding business, and we have the value prospect of its ability to compound over the long term, but also the fact that it is at almost a 20% discount to where it traded only recently in anticipation of the benefits of this merger. And that gives us the opportunity to buy it today. As we go through and look at some of these pages that we've put together to help us go through it, the company is Essilor. It's the number one global prescription lens producer. It has a extraordinarily high market share of 41%, more than three times that of its nearest competitor. It is vertically integrated in its supply chain, and it has a extraordinarily strong moat in its distribution, which goes to over 350,000 optical retailers, for whom they are the critical supplier alongside the providers of the actual frames. They are the global leader in advanced lens technology, and we'll talk a little bit more about what that means, with spending more than 200 million euros in research and development. Nobody in the world can afford to spend that kind of money on developing their business. They have significant growth opportunities in Europe and the US, so in developed markets, as well as in Asia and the rest of the world and developing markets, because of socioeconomics, growing populations, aging populations that have a greater need for vision correction, and higher incomes that mean that people can afford to buy glasses and lenses that allow them to see better, as well as the technical innovation driven by the R&D that they undertake. They are in a pending merger with Luxottica, which is the global leader in eyeglasses frames and in particular in sunglasses. We will talk a bit about them. They have consolidated over the years many, if not most, of the great global sunglasses brands. They have extensive franchising of brands for whom they are the sunglass partner, and they have their own distribution, which is among the leading retailers of sunglasses in the world. And we expect that from that combination, which has to do with good business in terms of strengthening the businesses, but also in terms of the succession at Luxottica, we think that they can achieve very significant synergies that will help to generate value and also mean, as we'll see later, that the combined company is significantly more attractive from a valuation perspective and is in fact cheap compared to the headline multiples that we see today. So just on the investment thesis, the eye care market is growing at 6 to 7% a year. The eye correction and eye protection markets, those are two different things, are underpenetrated with only 55% and 80% of the market that are still untapped. Eye correction is something that we're all used to, in particular as we grow older and spend more time in front of computer screens. But eye protection, which is the protection from UV light in the outdoors and from the harmful light that come from computer screens, is a market that we're only starting to understand. The blue light that comes from computer screens has significant impacts on our eyesight, in particular as we age, and is something that we all will need to consider in terms of the glasses we wear when we work in front of computer screens. This underdevelopment is particularly true for the U.S., where advanced lens technology such as Essilor's has not penetrated as much as much simpler and cheaper solutions. So people are learning about the benefits, and opticians are starting to get into understanding how to educate their customers in terms of the offerings and how they can help to protect and preserve their eyesight. And in China, there is simply significant untapped potential across the board, both in the areas where the GDP per capita is already at European and U.S. standards, as we know, as well as in the vast areas and populations that are still catching up. The thing about the market, and that gets back to the criteria we look for, is that the top three players have 63% market share in prescription lenses, and the remaining market is highly fragmented. The eye protection market is highly fragmented as it is. That means that there are significant scale advantages to Essilor, and that there continues to be significant potential for them to grow and generate value by consolidation. The merger with Luxottica, we'll talk about some of that also in a moment, is a unique opportunity for us to invest in an emerging global leader that we believe over the next 5, 10, and 25 years will be on a par with other global leaders in their industries. So we're at the beginning of a company that we will compare to a Louis Vuitton or to a Nestlé in terms of the scale of what they can do, the competitive advantage that they bring, and we think the value that they can generate over time. And that comes because of these criteria that I've talked about that we're looking for when we invest in companies. If we turn to the global market potential, then I'm just going to go through a couple of simple charts that mostly come from the company to just give you a sense of the scale of the opportunity that we're looking at, and therefore the scope of where it might head. So the global market potential for the company in 2015 was 96 billion of global optical market in value terms, meaning the market for contact lenses, eyeglasses, reading glasses, sunglasses, and frames. So this is the total market addressable for Essilor and Luxottica. And if you assumed that 100% of the vision needs were covered, then we that market potential would increase to 300 billion, so a threefold increase. Now, will we get to 100% of coverage, and will economic growth mean that there will be a time lag in terms of going there? Both of those are clearly issues, but it highlights the very significant market potential that these companies have. If we turn to the comparison of US and China, the US is the biggest market in value terms, but as I said, it is not yet as penetrated in terms of the more advanced solutions that Essilor provides. You see some of the brands here. Unlike what we're going to see in Luxottica in a moment, you won't recognize any of them unless you're an optician or have possibly just bought a pair of glasses and are highly aware of the lenses that you've put into them. But the penetration of these lenses is not at the level that it is at Europe yet. And so therefore, there is the biggest market in the world is still an emerging market for the lenses that Essilor produces. China is the second biggest market in the world with a market estimated size of at 10 billion, is clearly only going to grow, is of course an important market for branded sunglasses and eyeglass frames, but also is an important market for Essilor. And as you can see here, they have a combination of local brands as well as ones that are global across different functionalities and price points, which they're addressing that market. And we think that that has a very significant potential to be a driver for growth going forward. If we turn to the global need for vision, that just gives you from our work a little bit of granularity on what the market looks like. 72 billion people worldwide, 63% are in need of some kind of a vision correction, again, only expected to grow. 100%, excuse me, vision correction, if I didn't say that, 100% are in need of a vision protection, whether that's from sun and UV, with all the drivers that you can think of it, starting with climate change and cancers. And the impacts of light on our eyes as we grow older, or blue light, as I mentioned, from computers. On the vision correction side, of the 63%, 1.9 billion are corrected and 2.5 are uncorrected. You have both short-sighted and farsightedness. Clearly, one of the impacts takes place as we age and we need reading glasses, which is an almost universal requirement. And as we know, I'm certainly just going through it, the first step is to turn to the cheap glasses that you can get at practically anywhere. But very soon there's a need for actual prescription reading glasses and varifocals. As the eyesight changes. Of the uncorrected, 1.6 billion are in Asia, 550 million in Africa, and 170 million in LATAM, simply reflecting the very significant global growth that the companies has ahead of that. And of course, of the corrected, that represents the total and not at all within that the significant potential for people who are just using the most basic of lenses, but who would benefit from having more sophisticated ones. On the vision protection side, you've got 1.4 billion that are equipped. That includes sunglasses, but of course that's a moving definition, because what types of sunglasses with again what types of lenses? The market growth is significant. The idea of either a prescription sunwear or complementarity to contact lenses is significant, but 5.8 billion people are unequipped, which means there is an extremely significant market for Essilor from an actual functionality perspective in terms of, again, sunglasses and blue light protection, but of course also from a simple consumer perspective, people who might like to have sunglasses and who might be attracted to the branded ones that that Luxottica produces. So that's the very significant market potential that the company has. If we turn to the business model, then the moat that Essilor has for its supply chain is very significant. So globally, they have 32 plants to which they send both lenses and contact lenses to 16 distribution centers, from which they go to over 350,000 eye care professionals. That is a tremendous moat because these eye care professionals depend on the reliability and quality of their suppliers in terms of their business. So the idea of switching from a provider that is has those criteria is very difficult in terms of the range of products, but also in terms of the ease, the training, in terms of understanding the functionality that they offer, the selling process to convince customers of the benefits and of the ability to then deliver those glasses to their customers on time with a quality that the customer would expect. The similar goes for the emerging trend for e-tailers. Increasingly, eyeglasses are being sold online. That retail disruption is something that is of tremendous impact for the eye care professionals, whether they are through the large chains that are consolidating them and have economies of scale, or whether they are still through individual retailers, of which there are they're very significant. What's important for us with Essilor is that it is effectively disruption proof for that, because the e-tailers themselves have to source lenses for their glasses. They are themselves operating through more consolidated prescription labs, and therefore are the natural customers for someone like Essilor, who has the scale to supply them on a in a cost-effective way, and to be part of the scale advantages that they have compared to the actual retailers, opticians. So makes it very attractive for us, because we can be agnostic whether the growth takes place through opticians and the traditional channel, or whether it happens through e-commerce. Which is obviously one of the critical considerations that we have to have in our investments these days. If we turn to the actual products, again, it's something that many may be familiar with from their last visit to the optician, but eyeglasses are not just eyeglasses. The image on the left is a really instructive one to see the many layers of actual lenses and coatings is involved in a sophisticated a lens. So on the front of it, it's not just a piece of plastic or a contrabid glass. It's a tint. It's factors for smudge and water repellence, UV resistance and scratch resistance. On the back, it's not just the scratch resistance. It's efficiency in terms of avoiding lights. It's for dust, and then again the coatings for smudge and water. So a lot of ingredients that go into that. The e-mirror UV range is actually from an optician's website who advertise with it. The colors may not be to everyone's liking, and some may be more appropriate for a weekend use rather than the office. But you can see how there's an increasing sophistication and ability to differentiate yourself from these lenses. And that obviously is something that helps significantly for a company like Essilor. And if we look at the price bridge between these lenses, then on a monofocal, so So a simple eyeglass that you would use if you're nearsighted, the price difference goes from about 100 euros to up to 250 to 275 for a comprehensive upgrade, and that takes you from scratch resistance to thinner lenses to polarization and to anti-blue light, all of which are things that, if you think of the importance of your eyesight, are things that I think one needs to consider. And if you look at progressive lenses, which you need when you move from being nearsighted to then having difficulties reading, you start with 300 euros, and you move through the same steps of scratch resistance, thinner lenses, polarization, and anti-blue light to a total cost of over 530 euros. And not while, of course, these are important attributes, not unlike, for example, a car, which is maybe a more intuitive a comparison, these upgrades come at very significant incremental margins to the producer and are the basis for the attractiveness of the business. So that takes us to, I think, the two that has told us about the two key criteria for Essilor, which is the market growth and the differentiation and moat that they have in terms of their product. I want to just brief now touch on the merger with Luxottica, which is the leading producer of eyeglasses, frames, and sunglasses, and just to go through a chart that shows how incredibly complementary these two businesses are. So Essilor, as we said, is the global leader in ophthalmic lenses, which Luxottica doesn't really produce. Luxottica is the global leader in sunglasses and frames, which Essilor doesn't produce. Luxottica also has very significant retail and online presence in terms of the distribution of what it does, whereas Essilor is really a wholesale distributor and only has a very limited online presence for what they do. So it's a very natural and complementary fit for these two companies to come together, and we think that the combined competitive advantage and the benefits from the combination will be significant. If we turn to the leading global brands, it is interesting to see, as we said, how suddenly we recognize most of them, because on the Luxottica side in particular, they either own or have the franchises for many of the most recognizable and desirable eyeglasses and sunglasses. There's a reason why sunglasses of the branded type have become so expensive. That is because Luxottica and Safilo have consolidated the market, and very similar to what companies like LVMH and now Kering have done in luxury goods, have decided to up the quality, to limit the distribution, to cut out the discounts and the sales that wholesalers offered, and to increase the prices very significantly, being much more scientific about the price elasticity that people have. And it turns out the price elasticity on sunglasses purchases is such that people are prepared to spend vast amounts of money on a product that is easy to wear, easily recognizable, says something about people who care about those things, but is a fashion element, gets lost and broken, and has to be replaced. So we think it's a great market to be involved in, and together they now cover the whole range of lenses, sunglasses, and frames, and of the distribution that you need. And you can see that, in particular, in the case of Luxottica, they have through Sunglasses Hut and Pearle Vision have direct retailer, and LensCrafters have direct retailers in different markets. Where they capture the margin, and through brands like Ray-Ban and Oakley have significant omni-channel presence. that they're working on. It's Ray-Ban in particular, where they've limited the distribution, increased the prices, and made changes to the wholesale prices and discounts that has changed very dramatically how that brand is produced and how what the margins are. If we look at some of the numbers for 2015, you can see that the companies are also not dissimilar in size and in profitability, in leverage, and in market cap, which shows you that there it's the merger of two organizations that I think are very complementary, but also compatible from their businesses and from their management. Essilor has roughly 7 billion in sales compared to Luxottica's 9 billion for 15 billion of sales, EBITDA of 1.6 and 1.9 up to 3.5 billion. Essilor actually has slightly higher margins, as you might expect from someone who's a wholesaler who can add value through the R&D that it does with the coatings compared to Luxottica's very respectable 21%. And I think what's very important is that because it's a merger, the leverage of the company continues to be very conservative. We are absolutely advocates of efficient uses of balance sheets and of clear capital allocation policies, but we are very far away from saying that companies should leverage up for the short term and use the cash they raise to aggressively buy back shares or to have special dividends compared to investing for the long term. I think just as an aside, that's the most recent thing we've seen in Nestlé with the quote-unquote activism that it has been subject to, which really amounted to saying continue to do what you're already doing, just a little bit more and a little bit faster. But the idea of curtailing the long-term growth that companies like this can achieve by reinvesting for shorter-term returns, I think, makes no sense. And it's good to see that Luxottica, which is more family-controlled, and Essilor, which is a very well-run French company, have both resisted that and are investing very significantly in their businesses. From a share price perspective, you can see that since 2012, Essilor has done quite well. The share price has gone from 70 to a high of over roughly 124, 125, and has recently come back down towards the 100 level. The run-up, if you actually look at the price-to-earnings ratio that it's traded on since that time, has been entirely because of growth. That's in part organic growth that they've achieved. It's in part the accretive acquisitions that they've made. It is in part currency impacts that have taken place through translation. But the price to earnings ratio has been remarkably constant for a premium company like that with an average of around 25 times and a range that goes from roughly 18 to roughly 30. I really want to highlight that, because in the value investment discussion that we're part of and that you will also hear from others as you participate in this conference and as you read about it, there are different views on that. To us, again, as not so much Graham investors, but as Fisher investors, we're concerned with the long-term compounding, and therefore we are more on the side of my favorite Warren Buffett quote of it's better to buy a great company at a good price than a good company at a great price. Our track record bears that out. And I would say that looking at the five-year share price performance for Essilor, it very much bears that out as well. It's a very respectable compound return achieved at a more or less constant PE ratio. And to benefit from that return over that time, one would have had to look at that and say, well, first of all, we accept that a quality company like this trades at a multiple like that. But also to say that ranges of 10 to 20% around that are just part of what happens in markets and are really neither reasons, well, potentially obviously reasons to buy, because it's always good to buy at a bargain price, but are not reasons necessarily to sell and to go off and look for something else. If we're expecting to make 8 to 10% or more over the long term, a 10% discount to the multiple is obviously just 1 year of compounding, and as it's self-evident that it's a short-term and a pointless exercise to try to optimize it, certainly in terms of looking to adjust it at the top. The stock has flatlined over the last 2 years in aggregate. That has to do with the business, the currencies, and most recently with some of the uncertainty around it. If we look at the 1 year share price performance, that's where I would highlight the opportunity that we have, which is quite real. The share price has ranged from about 95 to 120, and is now at a price of 105. The company has had outstanding results in aggregate, but had a more recent issue where the company had suffered from somewhat dislocation because of uncertainty, in particular among independent retailers around the merger, and downgraded their growth from the 3 to 5% range to 3%. With results that has led to a reasonably significant share price reaction. We think the run up rather was in part because of the merger and the anticipation of the benefits, and so the fact that people have gotten a bit discouraged with the lack of clarity, we think is a positive aspect to it. The other thing is that the regulatory review of the merger, because of the strong competitive positions of the two companies, has taken somewhat longer than expected. We think that investors who've tried to align themselves for it, and analysts on the among the investment banks who cover it, are simply waiting for the certainty that the deal will actually go through. So to us, the idea of this dislocation of market share and business that we think they can win back against the backdrop of the growth that we talked about in the beginning is exactly the type of opportunity that we look for in terms of when we invest in companies. Finally, and in conclusion, why now? It is because of this opportunity. It is because of the expected completion of the merger at the end of this year, pending the regulatory review. And it is, of course, because of the valuation, which I want to talk about a bit. The numbers post what we think are very conservative assumptions on the benefits from the combination is for a 15% accretion by 2020. On a pre-synergy basis, we think the combined company is trading at a 2017 PE, so this year of 26 times, but that we think post-synergy goes down to a 2020 PE of 18 times. We think that that is a extremely attractive valuation in absolute terms. If you think of how we think about valuations with companies that can grow in the in real and in nominal terms in the environment that we're in particular companies that have the pricing power to offset inflation if we get it, we think that that is an extremely attractive measure. And if you look at the revenues and the earnings that we think that they will achieve, we're basically going off the $600 million of synergies that they've talked about, which we think are conservative, and we get to a growth in terms of the earnings of about 8 to 9% over the next 5 years, and including the synergies, a growth that is much closer to 12 to 15%. Over that time, which is this a very significant step up that we have. So that's what takes down the valuation. and really means that we think that buying such a globally leading company at that kind of evaluation is a real opportunity for us that we're certainly taking advantage of, and I think it's something that is worthy of thought as all of you listen to all of us talking about investments and thinking about how to do your own work on them and deciding what the criteria are, what your own investment convictions are, and whether this kind of investment fits into the portfolios that you are managing. So I'll leave it at that. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you, and I'll turn it back to John, and would be happy to answer more questions about what we do, about the other stocks, and about Essilor in a dialogue. Thank you.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for the compelling presentation. Maybe a question on what the combined company will look like. If you could shed a little bit more light on the management and whether we know the composition and the incentives that'll be in place post-merger.
Yeah. Well, as I said, the management is one of the rationales for the merger. The key rationale for the merger is clearly the combination of these two leading franchises and the competitive position that you have. Essilor has been has benefited, is one of the best managed companies we know, and in particular is one of the best managed French companies we know, which is actually a much smaller sample that you have. And we are the basic idea, but the second idea of the merger was the resolution of a succession issue within Luxottica. Luxottica's founder, who's also the controlling shareholder, is at a point where he is looking to pass on the control of the company, and has had two. Shares of has had two failed attempts, frankly, at finding a successor for himself. So with the extremely strong position that which the extremely strong position that the strong management rather that that Essilor has had, they're using the opportunity to have Essilor's management take over. So in particular, the Essilor CEO has done a phenomenal job in terms of building the company. The full board and management has not been announced. We're expecting that obviously with the completion of the merger. But you have Hubert Sagnier, who's been the chairman and CEO since 2012. He's worked at Essilor since 1989. And so we think that there's tremendous continuity, and the expectation is that it's going to be the Essilor management that will take over the management of the whole company. And it will move somewhat, while the Delvecchio family will have a significant stake continuing in the business. The management will be undertaken by the experienced and possibly more, with a management team with greater continuity, shall we say, in terms of being able to run the business.
Could you shed a little more light on the longer term capital allocation priorities, perhaps in particular as it might relate to share buybacks or dividends?
Well, the companies have a sensible, as I said, our basic framework, as I said, is that we're very concerned with capital allocation for what they as part of how we look at businesses, and we're looking for managements who have a very clear view on that. But if you think of capital allocation between reinvestment in the business through or to drive organic growth. Whether that is CapEx in terms of new plants or whether that's OpEx in terms of R&D and other expenditures, whether that's then capital allocation for external growth through acquisitions, whether that is then dividends, which are value neutral to us, or share buybacks, which are accretive depending on the valuation that they're executed at, then we look at all of those in terms of how a company should invest its capital. And we think that both companies, Essilor in particular, has a very rational and clear framework for that that we would expect to be replicated also at Luxottica. So from a, we are as long-term investors interested in really capital appreciation. We are not very concerned about dividends as such. The companies pay normal dividend rates that are ranging between 1 to 2% on our expectations that dividend yield will go up to 2% as the company generates more cash if they maintain their payout ratios, and obviously an assumption on the share price. But I think that but in aggregate, I think that the bulk will be towards reinvestment in the business, to some capex, and to a dividend policy that I think is responsible in that. That will clearly leave very significant room in terms of excess capital. And whether that gets spent through a more incremental consolidation, for which there is still some room, or emerging markets growth, which is my expectation, I think there will still be room. And I think when that time comes post-merger, that is part of the conversation that we're going to be having with the company, is to say, if you have a 40% payout, you have a significant reinvestment in the business, but you have this conservative leverage and no opportunities to deploy the capital in a way that is accretive, then we certainly will push for them continue to undertake share buybacks. With the growth that they've been having and the way that they've been managed, that hasn't been a significant issue for them, but we think it's part of what they need to think about going forward.
So-called challenger brands have been increasingly on the minds of investors across various consumer-facing industries, Dollar Shave Club perhaps being an example of that. How do you assess that kind of threat from potential new entrants?
Yeah. I think it's one of the great questions. To us, this disruption of business models, whether that's driven by digital transformation or whether it's simply driven by new and innovative business models, is absolutely crucial. And if you ask me what is that is what I spend most of my time thinking about and trying to verify in discussions with the companies, with their suppliers, with their customers, and in looking at both public and private companies that are engaged in that. So we spend a lot of time trying to get a view and to either to increase our conviction in the investments that we have. It's something that is, as you say, a big issue. It's become a big issue, as you say, a potential issue, and certainly a very interesting one for the classic, well, the original razor and blade company, Gillette. But it is also one that affects other businesses. So whether that's in the cosmetic space, effectively, well, potentially more or less any celebrity being able to launch a cosmetics brand simply on Instagram or Snapchat, or whether that is craft companies that are growing, especially in the States, but also in Europe, and are taking away on a really sustained basis market shares from the global leader Anheuser-Busch. It's a key issue that companies have. There's two aspects of that that apply to Essilor and to the combined Luxottica Essilor company. For Essilor itself, as I was saying, it's not a challenge because they are the dominant producer and technological leader in lenses, and the innovation of the brand that of the challenger brands is going to be around other aspects. In other words, it's around the fashion, around the frame, around whatever the statement is that you're making. I'm sort of thinking of what a value investor sort of group would look like if we started a eyeglasses brand. I'm not sure. we would be a lot more concerned with the blue light protection from staring at our computer screens than whether we were going to buy a eyeglass frame that was promoted by any particular value investor. And I think that sort of shows you on the Essilor side why they're so protected from it. And as I said, one of the unique things is really that they have that they're also insulated and actually benefit from the digital transformation of online retail, because they can supply those online whether that's brands or distributors, wholesale directly. That's on the Essilor side of the business. On the Luxottica side, it is an issue, but there's a big difference, which is that there are significant economies of scale in terms of the production of these glasses, and there's also, to a somewhat more limited extent, economies of scale in the distribution. But if you're going to produce these sunglasses, unlike, I think, in beer, unlike, for example, in cosmetics, you have a great incentive to go to one of the leading manufacturers, whether that's Luxottica or Safilo, and have them produce your glasses if you want them to have the quality and the recognizable attributes that you need to be able to sell them at a premium pricing. So nobody forces you to buy a Ray-Ban for $100 to $150 plus. You can buy sunglasses in a supermarket. So it's not that. And the production quality that's expected, we haven't seen yet, and I don't really expect to see that from a brand that might be a celebrity-driven one through social media. They have been going through the leaders, and I do think that the second thing is that the distribution is also very much controlled. So whether that's the actual captive distribution of a Sunglass Hut or a Lens Crafters or a Pearle Vision, or whether that's the online retail sites that have to be supplied, it's simply a lot harder. There's not many other companies that you could turn to. And we think that that's a competitive moat that they have. I'm sorry, the final thing is also that what all these companies do, what Anheuser-Busch tries to do, but it's difficult, what L'Oreal and in particular Estee Lauder do very successfully, and what Luxottica in its way is doing, is you buy them. So if you watch them very carefully, and if you see a brand that is successful, that is sustainable, you go off and you either buy it outright or you negotiate, more likely in their industry, a franchise deal with them. And because you have the scale to offer vastly better terms, you end up benefiting from it without having to go through effectively venture capital, A round and venture capital phase, where it's uncertain what the outcome is. So that's what L'Oreal and Estee Lauder have been able to do. That's what Anheuser-Busch is, and the other big beer companies are working on. But it's something that I think Luxottica and Essilor as a combined company will do a very good job of.
We will leave it there. Chris, thank you so much once again for being with us and for sharing such a well-researched thesis.
Well, it's a great pleasure to talk to you, and I wish you lots of luck with the conference, and everybody who's listening, lots of luck with your investments. Please keep your eyes on the long term. That's the most profitable way of going about it.
Thank you very much to all of you participating. Should you wish to follow up with Chris, feel free to do so directly or contact us, and we will be happy to introduce you. For now, goodbye.